Welcome to the Bull Gap Journal. We're here in the Radio Alabama studio, Sylacauga, Alabama. I'm Robert Holmes. Some of you around here know me as Bob, a community citizen, native of Sylacauga, and a proud veteran and community citizen. On the Bull Gap Journal, we talk about life, leadership, and common sense. Joining me today is a very special guest. We're going outside of the Central Alabama region down to Tampa, Florida. And joining me is a former special operations operator associate, but a very, very close friend. And that's Chief Master Sergeant Will Markham, retired. Chief, welcome.
Thank you, sir. So it is an honor to be here.
Well, no, the honor is ours, and I just really appreciate your taking time to be with us today. Chief Markham, how many assignments did you have as a command chief?
I had three assignments as a command chief.
Three as a command chief. So that's a level above Chief Master Sergeant in the Air Force or Sergeant Major. So Chief Markham, let me go into this a little bit here. A career Air Force Special Tactics Operator, Combat Controller, and the Chief has the distinction of being the first Air Force Special Operations person to set foot on the ground in Afghanistan in 2001 after we went boots and saddles to enduring freedom, getting after bin Laden and a gang of terrorists. And you were assigned to Army Special Forces Triple Nickel, right?
No. Yes, sir. Yeah.
ODA Triple Nickel. And yes, in that, Chief Markham also received the Silver Star for his combat valor and what he did there as a leader on the ground. So, Chief, I want to publicly embarrass you to just say, man, what a record! And I know you're a humble person, so you're gonna put that on other folks, but you did a lot there, and we appreciate that. I just want you to know it. So,
well, sir, I truly appreciate that, and you know, obviously, under your direct leadership for, you know, the Air Force soft forces that were involved, you know, going into Task Force Dagger and then into the South, you know, your leadership, I think, definitely is what, you know, put us on the forefront of the battlefield. So I want to say thank you for, you know, being that leader that we needed at the time.
Well, I certainly appreciate that, but I got to tell you, with the outstanding troops that you and I both know were there, it made that job easy. Okay. So I got to put that on the troops, man. It was nothing that a junkyard dog like me did. So, but I appreciate it. So, so total service in the Air Force, how many years?
30 years, 30 years,
30
days, something like that.
So when it all started out, did you think you would, be a Chief Master Sergeant and 30 years in the Air Force, or were you just sort of wandering in like?
Not at all. In fact, I had many mentors, many supervisors that said I would, you know, probably never make it past E5. My dad said I probably wouldn't live until I was 25. But it was, you know, my intention to join the Air Force was, you know, truly to be honest, was to be the closest thing to being a civilian as possible. I was going in a guaranteed inventory specialist, but I saw these guys working out, a bunch of pararescue men. Combat Control at the time in 1986 wasn't going through the OL there in Lackland, but I saw these PJs working out, and I just felt kind of a higher calling. Medical stuff didn't really attract me at all, just because it's just, you know, something internally. I get a little queasy at the sight of blood and guts and, you know, trying to fix somebody. But then I just ended up, inventory specialist was overbooked. So there was a lot more, I guess, kids in basic training that wanted to be as close to being a civilian as possible. And I ended up being a cop, security police, you know, cop rivets, out there on the flight line. And that was great. That gave me an opportunity to get into some pretty cool things like emergency service team, which is the Air Force SWAT team. I got to being Creek Defender. I got to compete in Peacekeeper Challenge and do Giant Sword for the old Strategic Air Command. And it gave me a sense of tactics and, again, a sense of really trusting the person to the right of me and to the left of me and wanting to keep those guys alive. And it just powered me to really research and look and what was available in the Air Force, and combat control seemed like the next, you know, the next step for me. And so that's what I wanted to do. And, even when I was combat controller, I would never thought I was going to be a chief master sergeant again, because I had great mentors and supervisors that told me, you know, yeah, you'll probably make it to master sergeant, but you know, that'll be it. But you know, it doesn't matter about what we did yesterday. It matters about what you're going to do today, and tomorrow, and hang around the right five people. So,
yeah. So what year was it that you were in security forces, or the, what folks would refer to as the air police, or, so you went towards security force, left security forces to turn to combat control about what year in service?
Yeah. Joined the Air Force in 1986, 1990, I put in my cross-train package, after my 4 years, and got approved and then started training in, the end of 1991.
Okay. Then, so at that point, So at some point you turned from, just wanting to do 4 years and be close to civilian life as you could, but you got bit by a bug, to serve and be part of something greater. How could you describe that?
I think it was just finding like-minded people and people that, were really good to be around. And, it was a blast. Like I had fun. You know, I always tell people, if you're not having fun, find something else to do. And I can honestly say, probably the first couple of years of my career wasn't too fun. I had a couple little missteps, and, probably my ego and I thought my limitations were a little bit further than what they really were. They always say a man's got to know his limitations. So, you know, I wasn't on the straight and narrow. I wasn't the best airman. But I had good supervisors that, you know, put their hands around my throat and, you know, grabbed me when they needed to. Told me this is the way you need to go, Markham. And so that was good. But it was a sense of being part of something bigger than myself, and being a part of a team and an organization where everybody strived to be their very best. And, you know, we may not have been the best looking or the best uniforms or the shiniest boots, but man, I got to hang around with some of the best operators that the United States Air Force, the Army and the Navy, and the Marines, could offer to us.
So an important lesson there is don't let the missteps keep you from eventually doing what you got to do, man. So that's good. Hey,
don't let the missteps, don't let one misstep or a couple missteps or seven or eight, judge the person that you're dealing with, because inside everybody has got something to give. And in some of us, it just takes a little bit longer to come out. And so I was fortunate to have, guys like, the late Bob Holler, Mad Jack McMullen, Charlie Ratt, Chief Martina, I had great chiefs that, stood up for us and pointed me in the right direction.
Well, I tell you, every one of those names you just named were mentors to me as well. And I go back, I can remember Chief Holler and so many others. So.
Yeah, and certain
let's go back
yourself, Bob Bucknell, or, Bucknell there, and, just all the great, senior officers that we had that came up through combat control, did great mentorship towards our guys.
So I want to go back to, because in 2001, you and I both were, inside, Afghanistan, and go back and just share a few minutes about that experience of joining up with the Joint Special Ops Team. You were embedded in a Special Forces Operational Detachment Alpha, Triple Nickel, and you crossed the border.
Well, sir, it was in our you know, we always say train like we're going to fight. And at a time and you know, when I came into combat control, we trained like we were going to fight. We were with our joint service brother,
right.
You know, going through combat diver school with the Army in Key West, you know, going through different training scenarios, going to Halo school, going to, you know, all the different joint schools that we went to, you got to meet your joint partners. And so immediately in Uzbekistan, when Colonel Piana and Kurt Buller and CMS Sergeant Elliott, you know, said, hey, Markham, you're going to be the first special tactics guy to get attached to an ODA team. And oh, by the way, you're going to be the first ones to go in Afghanistan. When I walked into that isolation tent, I mean, you know, again, and I stress this to our leaders today. In fact, I just had the conversation with General Arnefine at the Air Force Army game. Like, it is so important that we keep our heritage, that we keep our lineage and our ties to our sister service members. Rather than meeting them for the first time on the battlefield, we have to develop that relationship and training and build that credibility. And so when I walked into that isolation tent, Master Sergeant Greg McCormick, who was my swim buddy, we were swim team number two, I believe, swim team number two or one, but we were the fastest swimmers in combat diver school in Key West. And as soon as I walked into the tent, he looked around at his team and he said, oh my God, that's Will Markham. Or Calvin Markham at the time. That's the guy that drugged me through the water through scuba school. So there was an immediate credibility built with the team. Also, I had gone through Halo Jumpmaster with one of the other members of the team. So the butt sniffing, you know, there's always going to be butt sniffing. That's just the way we are. But the instant credibility and that was built with the team, you know, stepping into the isolation tent. Not only that, was a few months prior to 9/11, Silver Team, which I was on at the 23 STS, we were out in Tonopah in Vegas and Creech Air Force Base, you know, training with the Force Recon guys and the agency guys, you know, learning how to do this stuff that we had introduced in Afghanistan. So the connection and the credibility was already there. Now it was just a matter of going out on the battlefield and performing that way.
So what did it feel like when you stepped out of the stepped out of the chopper and said, man, I'm here now. We're here.
It was scary. I still joke about it. I still think Bowler and Decker were trying to get rid of me. No, it was surreal. Like we are going to combat. Yeah. I had gotten a little bit of a combat taste, you know, being in Africa, you know, being at the embassy in Liberia with General Canavan, the SOC Air commander at the time. And we were taking RPGs in from the street, from the, you know, the people that didn't really want us there so much. And so I had a little, you know, just a tiny little taste of what combat could be like. But here we flew in on two MH-47s from our Task Force 160th brethren. And, you know, hats off and my heart goes off to our Task Force 160 brethren who just lost an aircraft here in the Middle East. You know, they're always at the tip of the spear. They're always getting us where we need to go. In fact, when I served with them over in Afghanistan as the, you know, command senior enlisted leader, and they were, you know, under the command at General Ireland, and I had, you know, one thing about Task Force 160th is, you know, they're saying is infill is optional, exfil is not. So my heart goes out to our brothers who just lost five of theirs just recently.
Absolutely. But
we got on the ground and, you know, we weren't right in the exact landing spot that we were supposed to be, but, you know, that could be expected on any infiltration. And then we had swarms of people swarming in on us. We had no radio contact with them. We did know that they, you know, that they looked Afghani, you know, were they good or bad, but, you know, you fall back on your training and, you know, they ended up being the good guys along with the CIA agents that were on the ground. And, but we knew we were, you know, we were here for business. We were here to get a war going. And I was just, you know, I was more worried about, you know, we practice. I was more worried about, you know, screwing it up than anything. Right. So I was completely focused on the mission at hand. And that was to, you know, do my part and bring that air to ground interface and, you know, bring whatever I could to the team as we advance down towards modern airbase.
Yep. Well, it's that would have been just at tail end of October in 2001. And every year, and I'm sure you do the same every year about this time when we start looking at, the date of September 11th and moving then toward December of that year in January, my head, heart, all goes back to you and all of the team of special operators where I almost get a pleasant melancholy about that time. And, I just look back and it meant so much.
Yeah,
so.
I think it was our fifth attempt that we finally were able to, take off. And I got to say goodbye to Kurt Bowler standing on the ramp who, launched us from the airfield in Uzbekistan. But I think it was, if I can remember right, I think it was like the 13th or 14th of October, we finally did get our infill in. And then, within days after that, a couple more teams started getting to, their infill into Afghanistan. But yeah, it was very, very surreal, very, very real, very business oriented. Right. We knew we had to, I believe you were on the VTC prior to us launching when Tommy Franks and, President Bush were on there and, they said, we don't know whether to envy you or feel sorry for you because we think you're going on a suicide mission. Just of note, any senior leader out there, don't ever say that again to your force about to deploy into a combat situation because it wasn't very motivating for us to tell you truthfully, but it made us probably even a little bit stronger because, here are senior leaders like, man, they think we're going on a suicide mission. Well, I got something else for the enemy on the ground.
Yeah, good deal. So, for all of that, let me point out again, when I introduced you, were awarded the Silver Star for your actions in combat, your valor. So thanks again for just being who you are and what you did and being such a great member of the team. So
yes, sir.
Thank you
very much. That had that was on a huge part to you. And we just didn't have, we hadn't been at war yet. So everything was kind of new and, I am completely grateful and completely humbled by the award. I don't think it was necessary. I was just doing my job and I was keeping the people to the left and the right of me alive. And so I truly appreciate that honor and that privilege, but it's not why we do it.
Right. So, one thing I'm going to point out that you just alluded to is that we took an Air Force Special Operations team known as Special Tactics into the battle space. And we tried a lot of things there in real time in the battle space that actually began to shape and in some ways rewrite Air Force doctrine about combat operations, particularly with special operations forces on the ground who could then maximize the effect of air power in such ways that I think it even stunned, and it did stun, senior leaders at the Pentagon, at the Air Force, about how effective this force was on the ground. And you were part of that, you and all the folks that were on the ground making that happen. So it was just an amazing time.
That's the great thing about special operations is everybody brings a piece of pie to the, to the dinner table, and right. We all perform our, we should all perform our duties to the best of our ability and to our extent. In fact, we were running into cases before 9/11 where, I think commanders and senior leaders were looking at cutting the, at the time we called it SOTAC, Special Operations Terminal Attack Control Program. We were cutting that. We were cutting our training. We were cutting the number of combat controllers that we had qualified and certified to do this mission. And it just reinforced, this is a capability that we can, honestly and completely take on as certified air traffic controllers along with our tactical air control party brethren, to help us with the training and to help us with the manning side of it. That was something we finally started doing in later 2000s, like I think around 5-6 we started bringing our TACP brethren into AFSOC. But this was definitely a resource and a valuable combat tool on the ground to the teams. In fact, to the point where, the second team that infilled after Triple Nickel was ODA 595, a great team, but unfortunately they didn't go in with an air to ground liaison. They didn't go in with an airman, whether that be a combat controller or tech V.
Right.
They have horrible results on the ground trying to talk to air. In fact, we would try to do indirect cast to try to help that team. And finally it got noted and you know, probably on your part, sir, working with now retired John Mulholland and the team up at Task Force Dagger, was we had to get two Air Force air to ground interface. So we sent the combat controller and a TAC-P out to 595 to help them with their operations. And then, not that they weren't successful before, but they were very successful in the air to ground operations that they were doing after those two gentlemen.
To maximize the effect of the entire fighting, special ops fighting force to, the airmen can go along and actually be a force multiplier there.
Yeah.
So.
Absolutely. And my team, Triple Nickel, man, what a group of professionals. What a great, one, they were a combat dive team. So that says something about them right away. They're stepping above the other teams in my honest opinion, as well as for them to handle the stress and the, thinking outside the box for the situation we were in and doing unconventional warfare. And not only that, it was really easy. Steve Gruhl, the medic, Scott Zastro, the medic, JD Reed, the guys that were on the team were very eager and hungry to learn close air support and back me up if there was a situation. And, we were lucky. We had CAS 24/7. I had all the aircraft that were sent into that theater assigned to our team, and we're the only ones doing effective cast at the time. And so I did need that backup. And so those young professionals that were on the team with me were able to help provide that as well.
Yeah. For the folks listening, CAS is close air support. That's a lot of air power with firepower overhead, and then control it and get it on target on time to do what's got to be done. So folks, we're visiting with Chief Master Sergeant Will Markham, Air Force retired special operator. And we've just been talking about his experience in Afghanistan after we went in, after 9/11, and very important story that personally I just don't want us to forget about. We're going to come back with Chief Markham after we take a short break. Join us and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the Bull Gap Journal. I'm Robert Holmes, host, where we talk about life, leadership, and common sense. If you watched part of the first segment, you know that we're visiting with Chief Master Sergeant, Air Force Chief Master Sergeant Will Markham, retired Air Force Special Operator. And we talked about the events right after 9/11, going back to the year 2001. And how significant that was, really, and burned and etched in a lot of our memories about, what special operations brought to the fight there. Chief, one thing I want to mention is recently you, in addition to all of the awards and the accolades that you got on active duty, and I'm going to let you tell us about, you were the recipient of the Master Sergeant John Chapman, Service Before Self Award. Would you tell us a little bit about that, the meaning of it, and particularly the meaning to about Special Operator, Air Force Special Operator John Chapman?
Yeah, absolutely, sir. And just a correction, I don't think I ever received an award on active duty. In fact, I dodged some more Article 15s and some letter stuff like that.
Because, Article 15.
We just were, we were just trying to, live day to day and get by and, try to do things to the best of our ability. But, like my dad said, and sir, you've said this many times, don't rely on the past. You're judged upon what you're going to do today and tomorrow. And so after retirement, I wanted to use the platform I had as a retired Command Chief Master Sergeant to do good for our veterans, do good for our service members. And, And I just remember working for people, you know, coming up through the ranks that were more worried about their own career than they were about the, you know, the careers of their, you know, subordinates and their peers and even their leaders. You know, today, some of the great officers that I got to work for have moved on to be general officers, and they're doing wonderful things in our United States Air Force and our United States Army. A lot of my peers have gone off and now they're CEOs of big companies. And a lot of my subordinates are now chief master sergeants, command chief master sergeants. And so that's just really wonderful to see. The John Chapman Award, the leadership award for service before self is very humbling because I didn't know John that well. I had met him a couple times. He was just, everybody had just always explained him to be, you know, an incredible operator, and what he did at the 24 SCS was just above and beyond. But for him to be put into a situation, be attached to a team and go on and do incredible things. In fact, the first time I got to watch the Predator video from the agency that Dan Schilling and the team all put together was that week at the academy when we were there. Myself, Dan Schilling, Mike LaMonica, two wonderful, you know, combat controllers, a former combat controller, now special tactics officer, retired, but just two great mentors to hang out with and really bounce ideas and feelings off of. But again, it's just, you have to take care of yourself. But it's more importantly, I believe, to take care of the people around you and that are going to be with you. So to see the family, get to be with them, you know, it's just humbling. It's just, you know, how can you even think of being mentioned in the same sentence as John Chapman?
So as we create the awareness about John Chapman. John Chapman was a member of our community, an Air Force special tactics operator that was assigned to a special team and on a mission went to the top of one of the mountains, Take Agar. We also call it Robert's Ridge because it was with a SEAL team deployment. And folks may remember that Navy SEAL Roberts fell out of the aircraft that had taken some ground fire, and it cut some hydraulic fluid. He slipped, fell out of the back, and John Chapman, along with some of the other members of the SEAL team, went back to not leave. We don't leave anybody behind, so they went back. And Sergeant Chapman engaged Taliban forces on top of the mountain, sustained wounds. Immediately they thought, or the first thought was, is that Chapman had been killed in the first firefight and foray. We had video footage from a Predator that showed that John lived on for hours after that and was even alive, engaging the enemy when the rescue, the quick reaction force came back with the Rangers in order to retrieve the SEALs and Chapman himself. But John was still alive fighting, and that ultimately, you know, led to him being awarded the Medal of Honor here about 2 years ago, posthumously, for his his valor.
Experts have looked at that video, and if you look at it, the two separate firefights that he had been in, one to save his team as they exfiled down the mountain and left him, and then the second was the firefight he got into to, you know, save as many people on the helicopter for the QRF that was coming in to rescue him. It's worthy of two Medal of Honors. So
sure,
Congress and people can get their heads where they're supposed to be and hopefully get that second Medal of Honor awarded, because he absolutely deserves that.
Yeah, and an amazing display of courage and valor, and it leads to this whole core value of selfless service. So Chief, again, you were recognized as being now a humble servant and doing what you do. You're engaged in a number of veterans outreach activities. You're wearing a T-shirt that says POVAT. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, so when I first retired, I went and worked for a great veteran nonprofit that, you know, one of our very own, John Carney, you know, really helped put on the map and get stood up and help the children of our fallen of our fallen special operators get the proper education and the proper benefits they needed to go on and be successful young men and women in our communities, and also become, you know, some really good members of our military as well. But there was this more of a higher calling with some problems that I went through with the Department of Veteran Affairs. And here I looked at, you know, I'm a retired command chief, 30 years, you know, significant injuries, significant, you know, non-visible injuries as well as visible injuries. And just the way that that I had gotten diagnosed and treated from the VA of what my comp and pen should be, or what we say disability, I didn't think was right. And as I researched this more, I found more members, more service members of all walks of life, not just special operations, because nobody's better than, you know, any other person out there. Everybody has served. Everybody that has served should get the right compensation and pension that they've earned and deserved, regardless of, you know, who they are, who they served with. Nobody should be treated any better than anybody else, but it's on the individual to get where they need to be. With that, I found that there were organizations that charge veterans to get them to the right compensation and pension, which I thought was a little bit, you know, not criminal, but just something that we really shouldn't deal with. And then there are those free organizations that do it for free, but they're so inundated by the, you know, we have 16.5 million veterans, you know, alive today in our nation. And so they're just over, you know, they're just over inundated. So what we did is we started a program, myself and my two co-founders, Jeff O'Hara and Dr. Mark McLaughlin. We started a project after the 2.5 year battle I had with the VA. We didn't celebrate. We didn't go up there and high five everybody. We said, all right, tomorrow, who is the next veteran we're going to get through our program? And it's a referral process. So somebody that goes through our program, such as I did, I got to refer our next veteran. And then when that person got through, you know, the program a little bit, then they referred the next veteran. And now, since starting in 2019, we're at 175 veterans into our program, about 90 cases that we have completed. And this year for 2023, we took on 65 cases. Our goal was 60 cases, but you know, funding and resources, we ran out. And I'm a big believer in you get what you pay for. And so we, Project OVAT, we pay the experts. We pay an outstanding medical consultant. We pay a psychological consultant. We pay a great legal team to fight these cases for our veterans. To make sure we get the, you know, we want a special operations team to go in there and go to war with the VA. I don't mean that literally, I mean that figuratively. But we want to, you know, we gotta represent. And when we come in, we come loaded for bear, and everything is, I's are dotted, the T's are crossed, the paperwork's filled out the way they need it. And so there should be no question to the level of compensation and pension that veteran should get. And, you know, we want to make sure that our veterans get the best care and the best things we need. And now through a financial analysis, a forensic analysis of what we've done on our veterans that have completed the system, they're getting over $500,000 back, you know, to them over their lifetime, to the rest of their, you know, for the rest of their living life. Tell me another veteran organization that does that for them. You know, and the reason why this all got sparked was I had a senior officer tell me while I was going through my battle, and I was like, hey, there's got to be something we can do about this. And he said, well, Charlie Mike, you know, comp and pen, VA disability is a lot like awards and decorations. Some people get them, some people don't. And that was the fire. That was the punch I needed.
The light bulb went on and said, yeah. Got it.
All right. I will do something about it. And, you know, I will do this to my dying breath. I will make sure the veterans that get referred to Project OVAT will get the compensation and pension that they've earned and deserve, and that they can take care of their family and they can be a good member of our community and our society and go out and do wonderful things and lead by example.
Right. So POVAT is the Project One Veteran at a Time, POVAT. Project One Veteran at a Time. And that's the way it's really, it's meant to not treat people as a mass or a herd, but to take one veteran, get them through whatever it is they're battling now as a veteran, to connect with the VA or what other agency might be needed to help them. And that I applaud that effort. One reason we wanted this message here in Central Alabama is, there are a lot of veterans here in Central Alabama, and there are some veterans programs emerging. I'm aware of several of those. But I wanted to put a catalyst in the middle of our discussion here, Central Alabama. So, Chief, that was why I wanted to get that message out here in this segment, as we look at our veterans here in Alabama, and they're being taken care of somewhat, but we can do more. So,
yeah. And the other thing, I should have went to a better business school, because me and my executive officers, we don't get paid. We volunteer to do this because it's the right thing to do. And I want to put the money we raise in donations and sponsorships towards my, my SWAT team, my SEAL Team 6, my, combat action group. I want to put the money towards my doctors, my lawyers, and my psychologists that go and, battle with the VA to make sure we get the right amount. And as a retired senior enlisted leader, this is still my service back to my veterans and whatnot. So
you can't quit serving. I mean, once you get the bug to serve and provide stuff, you got to keep doing it. So
exactly.
Good on you, man. Hey, so I want to close out, and let's go back to what we're talking about are those the core and fiber of a warrior, and their values that are there that. One, the warrior brings, the veteran brings to life, brings to a passionate endeavor like you're doing now with veterans and leadership. So if you were to look at the value that you would sort of point to as being at the top of a list, what would that personal value be?
Oh, man, put me on the spot. I would say humility.
Well, I like to do that deer in the headlight looks, but you get the best answers. you get the best answers, but there's some value that drives you still that you learned early, and it's still a driver. What would that be?
I always say take emotion out of the equation, fill your life with passion, because passion equals love. And I think that value of serving others before yourself, that will just make a world a wonderful place.
Great answer. Forgive me for putting you on the spot there, but like I said, the heartfelt responses come when you put that penetrating question in there, and I think you were dead on. So thank you, Chief. Thanks for your service. Thanks for what you. Did, but now importantly, thanks for what you're doing. And you've taken it on in a leadership role to do the right thing. And I appreciate your doing that. So, and thanks again for just taking a few minutes to visit with us on this interview, today.
I owe you a ton of thanks. I owe you for all the mentorship and leadership you've given to me throughout my career. I remember, coming back from Afghanistan and, just wanting to get back to the teams and, start training again. And you dragged me and Rick Triggers up to the Pentagon and, we started giving those speeches, because if you treat yourself so secret or so behind the curtain, we don't get that money from Congress. And so you really, truly helped me develop into a stronger NCO, a better senior NCO. And so, General Holmes, I would just like to say thank you for all the time you spent with me and helped me become a better person.
Thanks, but I got to tell you, it's you guys that inspired me and kept driving me forward. So thank you. So, folks, we've been talking to Chief Master Sergeant, Air Force Chief Master Sergeant, retired Will Markham, Air Force Special Operator. We talked a little bit about his military service, particularly his combat service in Afghanistan. And there were some other combat operations that we didn't refer to. And then importantly today, to continue to serve and provide for our veterans. And that's hugely important, particularly as we begin to look around our neighborhoods, our communities here in Central Alabama, and wanting to make more available for our veterans. So, Chief, thanks again for joining us. And thank all of you all for tuning in to the Bull Gap Journal, where we talk about life, leadership, and common sense. If you like what you've heard on the Bull Gap Journal or what you've seen, go to radioalabama.net/bullgap.